Welcome to this special Independence Day weekend edition.
I'm Patty Sue Spires.
And I'm Richard Randall.
This morning, we celebrate the renewed patriotism and love of freedom. We do it by looking back
to the heroes of a prior time.
A dark time, not just for our country, but for the entire world.
A time when freedom was at stake. We look at a group of World War II veterans who, in their own way, are as active today as they were more than half a century ago.
It is 1942. The 44th Bomb Group is part of the 8th Air Force. They're stationed in Shipdham, England.
They were known as the Flying Eight Balls. Their mission was to bring the war to the German homeland, to punish them by air, and to bring them to their knees. They will be there until they achieve that goal, but it will take until 1945.
They flew B-24 Liberators, four-engined heavy bombers capable of striking deep into Europe. By the time their work was done, the 44th would lose 152 planes and 850 crew members. Will Lundy was a crew chief, and he recalls the early days of the war.
When we first went to war, our plane was a peacetime airplane, never been used in combat, and we had to convert that to one that could stand up against the enemy. It had no armament on it. So it was a matter of learning all the things that were wrong. The superchargers would not operate at high altitude. All of this contributed to frostbite for our poor people that were up there. Some would be injured. The high altitude would get to the ears. So the combat crews were rapidly disappearing. So they asked for volunteers. It was a year before we really got replacements. Almost a year of combat. My 67th Squadron went over with 9 planes, 10 men to a plane, 90 men, 2 people completed their tour. The rest of them were either injured, wounded, ear problems, or shot down, either prisoner of war or killed. 2 men. The B-24 was designed to defend itself against all odds. It couldn't do it, because the Germans were just as determined as we were. Their pilots were just as good and just as determined as we were. And our gunners were not well enough trained. We had shells that were just strings of 50 for our machine gun. But when the machine guns went brrr, and that was gone, they were out. Our guns would, first part of the war, but as soon as they got to, say, 10,000 feet, icing conditions, the machine guns would freeze. And these poor guys would say, they keep their guns warm. Their guns would freeze. And then the Germans come in on them and have no protection.
Historian and author Stephen Ambrose.
Everybody knows the B-17. But there were 5,000 more B-24s than there were B-17s. The B-24 could fly higher, faster, and carry a bigger bomb load.
Bombardier Bill Fitzsimmons flew 29 missions at the age of 22.
The B-24 is a heavy old bomber. It was built to be a transport airplane, but they converted it, put in bomb racks and all that stuff. And it was built like a bee, it had a heavy body and small wings. Scary as hell, you know. You could look out and those wings are going up and down. But on the ground, probably one of the ugliest aircrafts I ever saw. In the air, they're beautiful, you know, particularly en masse. But if you read the statistics on them, they shouldn't have flown at all because of the structure, the body weight and the wing. And they had a double tail.
The pilots and the rest of the flight crew got most of the glory, but they couldn't do their job without the ground crews that were led by men like Will Lundy.
It was our plane. No, it wasn't the pilot's plane. He thought it was his, but it was our plane. So, yes, that was a full concentration. Yeah. I've worked on them 36 hours straight. We were there to stop the Germans. When we first arrived there, it was very, very likely that the Germans were going to invade. So we knew we were there to stop the enemy.
Colonel Roy Owen, B-24 pilot.
Probably one of the biggest underestimates that Hitler made was that he thought that the pampered American youth who hung out in pool halls and danced the swing and were, you know, ne'er-do-wells, that they would never, never stand up before the disciplined German soldiers. He didn't understand teamwork and ingenuity. We were all tinkering around with our Model Ts and Model As. We were tinkerers and, you know, ingenuity and as opposed to the young German mind, disciplined mind of the Nazi fanaticism. We had a bunch of free thinking, you know, hanging out kids, but they weren't ne'er-do-wells. They were talented, and when they put them together with this mentality of, I'm gonna be with my buddies, I won't fail my buddies.
Most historians, like Stephen Ambrose, believe that Germany would never have been defeated without the air war.
The air war paralyzed the Germans. We paid a big price for it, of course. It cost an awful lot of men that were very highly trained, but the air war paralyzed the German army. They hit those marshaling yards, they hit those railroad bridges, they hit rolling stock, so that by the last year of the war, the Germans hardly had a train left. They also hit the oil refineries again and again with very heavy losses at Ploesti. One quarter of the bombing force shot down, another quarter badly shot up, and another quarter some shot up. And that's in one battle in one day? Jesus Christ. But they kept after Ploesti and the other oil refineries, so they reduced the Germans. The tanks couldn't roll. They had to dig them in and make them into fixed fortifications. They had no trucks. They were reduced to being a horse-drawn army fighting a 20th century war. And that never could have happened without the Air Force.
Early in the war, the odds were against the 8th Air Force. The 44th Bomb Group took heavy losses, but some, like Colonel Roy Owen, had a different kind of fear.
The biggest fear I had at age 19 was that I was going to get left behind. All my buddies were going in, and I was so damned afraid that I wasn't going to get in there with them. That was my motivation. And it was, it was that way all the way through pilot's school. To God, I lived in fear that I was going to wash out, that I was going to, I didn't even think about being a hero, or it was a grand crusade. I mean, it was a fortunate circumstance as far as going to war, because the 44th was probably one of the most prestigious bomb groups in all of 8th Air Force. When I got there, they were already legend for the famous Ploesti raid on the Romanian oil fields on the 1st of October of 1943, for which they were presidentially cited.
Top turret gunner Jack N. Payton flew 31 missions.
We had a real good crew, but we had good men on the trip each time, and we had a lot of respect for each other. We had to keep working to keep them sober sometimes. We knew that at any time we were on the way over or back, coming back, we could be killed. I mean, we didn't dwell on it, we didn't make a big deal about it or anything, but it's just that simple. War is hell, that's all there is to it.
Bombardier Bill Fitzsimmons.
Well, I went to Shipton in December of 43. From there, it was complete detachment from the war. I'd crawl in that airplane and just hope, you know, for the best. And I had the navigator in the nose with me, and he was a character. He's wheeling around in there one day, and I thought, God, you know, Bob's been drinking, and it's awfully early in the morning. But, you know, come on. God, he's, you know, he's plowed. And and he kicked his connection to the oxygen out. So we finally figured that one out.
They became the closest of friends and remain so to this day.
Author Stephen Ambrose.
Combat does that to men, because your life is dependent on the other guy, and his life is dependent on you. And you've got to count on his knowing and being able to do his job. And they all depended on the pilot. But he depended on his radio man, his navigator, his bombardier, his waist gunners, his tail gunner, his ball turret gunner. And that life or death dependency creates friendships that are just unknown to civilians. There's nothing in the civilian world to compare.
Colonel Roy Owen.
We all had that feeling it was going to happen to somebody else. What's going to happen to me? The motivation, even when you've got gut-wrenching, piss-in-your-pants fear, you're going to go because you don't want to let your buddies down.
But this was war, and the losses were great and often personal. Will Lundy explains.
He was a very good friend. He says, Will, he said, will you hold this letter for me? And I said, sure. And he says, it's for my girlfriend. He says, if I don't come back, would you please deliver it to her? So you had this connection, and he made it through Ploesti. And the next mission, he was shot down and killed. So I had to deliver that letter to his girlfriend. So for those reasons, you didn't want to know anybody. That's too tough.
How many times can your heart break?
Oh, every time a plane went down, every time a crew didn't come back. It was a defeat. That's why I'm a historian right now, is because I wanted to find out what in the world happened to these planes. Because you say, was it our fault? You always wonder that. When that plane doesn't come back, you're
right.
Soul searching.
Bill Fitzsimmons and one of his pilots are still trying to figure out just what happened to one of their downed planes.
We inherited one called the Princess, and I understand Ralph has made a lifetime commitment to finding this particular ship, and he's done very well. He was my first pilot.
President of the 44th Bomb Group's Veteran Association, Colonel Mike Michalowski, explains the complicated procedure in finding and recording the crews that went down over 60 years ago.
When you get notice that somebody you knew were missing in action, there's always that hope in mind that maybe they survive, that one of them survives. As long as it's never been confirmed, if all I got is MIA. So for years, occasionally, when I would contact somebody who flew on that mission, I began to reconstruct what had happened. But I could not close the books, except that they were killed. Came in contact with a Romanian former officer, the Romanian equivalent of our graves registration. I said, I'm trying to find out what happened to a crew that I used to fly with, that I have still strong feelings for. They've never been reported as killed in actions. Can you help me? He confirmed to me that they were killed in action. I said, why did it take so long? Mm-hmm. He said, the reason for it was that the Germans, some of the Germans and even some of the Romanians, used to take the dog tags as souvenirs. And when the bodies are so badly charred and burnt up, it takes years to finally identify them. So that sort of closed the chapter on that. Then I wanted to find out where they were buried. You want to reach out for that last contact, and you want to revisit, you want to touch it, you want to see it, because throughout the years you paint all kinds of other images in your mind, none of which are real.
This is where that old American ingenuity has resurfaced. These 44th Bomb Group boys with a mission have become once again a well-oiled machine working for their friends and families.
Our business is really this thing of putting families relatives and former pals, former crew members that have lost track of their their wartime contemporaries, and we get them back together again, and we reunion once a year. The capability of being able to help these people that are searching for someone has been facilitated by the fact that we have the best archives of any bomb group that I know of, and that's to the credit of a former B-24 crew chief by the name of Will Lundy. He started out fearful that the crews that were lost would not be properly honored. When a crew was lost, the intelligence people made out a form called a missing aircrew report. So Will made himself available and get into those things, and really what he did was compile every missing aircrew report in the 44th Bomb Group, every loss.
Tony Mastrodone was a medic in 1942. His curiosity drove him to seek out his old comrades.
Well, what actually happened in 1982, they sent me a publication, and I was interested in two pilots that I knew they went out and they were lost on missions. And I often wondered what actually did happen to them.
Did you find these guys that you were looking for?
I found what actually happened to both of those crews. And one of them had crashed on the coast of Sweden, and the other one got shot down over Germany.
Tony tells of how one of his frostbite patients was reunited with the one who had doctored him so long ago.
I was such and such, and I was on a crew number, this and that and the other. He says, you took care of me. I said, when was this particular flight? And it was in February of 43. I said, well, how could I have taken care of you? Did I give you a place at a wash basin or a sink with your hands in the water because you was frostbitten? He says, yes, that's what happened. He says, you took care of me that way. And you didn't have that many sinks and wash basins around, so you'd use pots, pans, tin cans, whatever you could, and let them soak themselves in. But then the tissue would die. I've seen them with all their fingers just turned black, and the tissue was falling off. I asked this one surgeon, I said, well, what do you do in a case like that? He says, we're sending them back to the States.
Tony Mastrodone may have been doctoring frostbite in 1942, but in 2002, he is now a devoted archivist for his 44th Bomb Group. He spends days in the tightly secured National Archives in College Park, Maryland, searching through boxes of aircrew reports, looking for lost planes and their crews. Bombardier Bill Fitzsimmons was recently reunited with one of his pilots at a San Diego reunion after 60 years.
Actually, I had a preconceived idea what Sydney might look like. Totally wrong. I didn't recognize him. I saw Elizabeth first, and the only reason I knew who she was, she had a name tag on. And I asked her, where's your husband? And she said, I think he's on the elevator, you know. I know one thing we talked about, and Sidney denies it. He wanted to buzz the base on his last mission. That means flying low, and he did. We prayed. We got down and prayed, please, Sidney, no. Please don't do it. And he comes in, and there are leaves in the leading edge of the wing to prove it, you know. Yeah, he denies that he did this. I told him he could relax. Nobody's after him, you know.
I ask him why it had taken so long to come to one of the gatherings.
It's because we don't say goodbye. We always, in our minds, we say, we'll run across each other again.
Estelle Volker's husband passed away a couple of years ago. For her, being part of the 44th Bomb Group family keeps her connected to those who meant so much to him.
He did 35 bombing missions. He also did a couple of clandestine missions. He also did weather missions, target missions. He'd even take co-pilots up to give them extra training when he wasn't flying a mission.
So he loved it.
He liked flying, yes. Will Lundy happened to spy him and told him he had been looking for him for years. Couldn't find him. Well, Will was the historian of the 44th Bomb Group, and he was trying to get a hold of as many as he could. He was the first lieutenant when he went over, first lieutenant when he came back. He made captain one day, but was immediately demoted by Colonel Snavely, who didn't like him. So he was only captain for a few hours. He should have been captain, though. He was really one of their best pilots. He always got his plane back.
But probably their biggest victory of recent has been bringing together fathers with their daughters. Colonel Roy Owen talks about one such case.
Her name was, her married name is Lois Cianci. Her father, her maiden name was Schaefer. She was the daughter of an enlisted crew member in the 44th Bomb Group. His first name was Claire. Didn't know him from ever. He was shot down a year before I got over there. He went in the service, wrote V-mails to her constantly, and he adored her and her memories of him and the pictures. She was 4 years old when he was killed. The thing I was able to provide to her, the first time I talked to her, I immediately got a hold of Will Lundy, our historian, and of course he came up with the missing aircrew report, which is more information than she had ever had. She had zip.
The World War II pilot of six decades ago, with others from the 44th Bomb Group, went back to find where Lois's father's plane had gone down over France.
So the next morning, we mounted up, and my golly, we had about a half a dozen cars full of French people that tagged along, and away we go out into the country, and we go up a little country road, and finally we got to a place where we parked the bus, and then we hiked up a barely discernible little trail up about 100 yards or so into a nice little forest. And pretty soon, here's a little sign on the wooden sign nailed to a tree that I think it just in French said crash site. Inside of the little chained enclosure are some charred pieces of B-24 wreckage. Piece of bulletproof glass from the windshield of the cockpit and some other pieces of metal. Lois knelt down and she was stroking those pieces of the shards of glass and things. God, there wasn't a dry eye in the crowd, you know. And then he stands up and he kind of calls everybody together. He starts to speak in French, but he keeps mentioning the name Schaefer. God, pretty soon he opens his jacket, his coat, and he reaches in his breast pocket. He pulled out this little box, gave it to Lois. She opened it up, and this fire-blackened dog tag. And he handed it to her, and she took it to her lips and kissed it. We were all it was so emotional, you can't believe it. We walked up there in a light mist. And at that moment, the overcast, the fog sort of parted, and the sun shone through the trees down on that scene. God, it was so beautiful. It was just incredible.
60 years ago, Will Lundy was a crew chief. Now he serves as historian. Tony Masterdone was a medic. Now he's an archivist. Colonel Michalowski was a navigator. Now he's president of the association. And Colonel Roy Owen was a pilot who started the 44th Bomb Group Veterans Association. Together, they're all still doing what they did so well so many years ago. Comrades working together, watching out for their buddies and their buddies' children. The future of this country.
When we sat down, and she said, "Let's see, Grandpa, you were in World War I? I said, "Well, it really doesn't matter." But no, that was a little earlier than Grandpa entered the war. I said it was World War II, and then we took off from there. So at the end, she says, "Well, you know, Grandpa, I loved you very much, you know, and you're my greatest inspiration." She says, "But now, I think you're a hero."
All gave some, and some gave all, and some stood through
white and blue, and some had to fall. And if you ever think of me, think of all your liberties and recall. Some gave all.
I'm Richard Randall.
And I'm Patty Spires. And thank you to the brave men of the 44th Bomb Group for what they did.
And what they continue to do.
Some gave all. Some.